This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for taking time to listen to us here at WNRN. Guest today, Dr. Mike Feats. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
On a day that's actually pretty nice and not 105.
True, true.
Yes, and we're still inside enjoying the beauties of the WNRN studio. Mike is at Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in Charlottesville, degree from Cornell, and also in the last year or so become a regular contributor to the Sevo Weekly with an interesting article about articles about living with pets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I find that to be fascinating. We're going to talk about a little in-depth or, you know, lightly covered about some of those particular stories. I find some of those hysterical and really informative. They go both ways, so good job.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, trying to keep them readable.
And you do well.
Thank you.
You can also find them online if you haven't read them all or want to hear a little bit more about some of the topics we cover. Sevo Weekly. I guess it's probably .com, but if you Google Sevo Weekly and pets, you'll come up with Mike, and then you can research from there some of the specific articles.
If you put my name in the search box, you'll get the whole list.
Yeah. Yes, but Feats, how do you spell that?
It's tough. It's F-I-E-T-Z.
Right.
Yep.
So that throws people
the e
off
and the
a
I,
little
yeah.
bit. All right, we will be taking calls throughout the hour. In fact, we'll take them as soon as the first person's ready. I did get a few questions via email or Facebook page, but 979-0919, that's 434-979-0919, as we talk about. I'll take questions, give out some answers, conversations about our pets, dogs, cats. Do you have specialties in other small animals?
No, we only do dogs and cats, yeah.
All right, so let's limit it to that. Yeah. Questions about gerbils and rabbits.
Yeah, I can't.
Maybe not here today.
Can't fix up your spider.
All right, so 434-979-0919. Our guest today, Dr. Mike Feats from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital. And again, I got some questions via online, email, Facebook page. And so we'll jump into a couple of these that I got right away. Somebody sent me one that says, is frontline, in all caps, really necessary?
I guess it depends on how we're defining necessary. It's
and frontline being
frontline is a flea and tick preventative. You squirt it on their neck and generally monthly. It's not necessary in that if an animal doesn't have it, they're not gonna nothing awful is gonna happen. You're just leaving them vulnerable to fleas and ticks. Certainly in an area like this, it's wise to use it. I think it varies a little bit based on lifestyle, time of year, everything else. And your previous history with fleas. If you live in a home where you've dealt with fleas before, they can really stay resident in the house for a long time. They have these little, the younger form of the flea can basically live in the carpet, I mean, almost indefinitely when protected from the weather. And it's very easy for the problem to come back. So leaving them exposed and allowing it to come back, it's just not good for the animal's comfort and their well-being. Necessary as far as, comparing to something, for instance, like heartworm preventative, I think, if I had to rank them, I think heartworm preventative is more necessary because you're preventing something that's actually fatal, whereas with fleas, you're preventing something that's, a terrible nuisance. So for most animals, I think it makes sense to use something like that.
And you, actually, that was one of the articles that, in fact, I felt like sending this back to my friend saying, see article XXX at the Sevo Weekly column, but you spent an entire column talking about fleas more so than ticks, but because they are so difficult to get rid of. And one of the pieces that you put in your article was, hey, this is not a, you don't give them frontline and expect the fleas to go away permanently.
Yeah.
It's not a one-time dosage to solve the problem.
It's a long fight. The way they insinuate themselves into a home, they really make themselves permanent residents. So once you've got the problem, you really need to control it for a very long time. I mean, months and months and months before it finally whittles away. When you look at a home that has fleas, only a small number of the total fleas in that house are actual fleas that you think of, you know, hopping around on the dog. Most of them are in different stages of life and just waiting to come back. And, you know, I think there are unreasonable expectations put on these products where, you know, people will come in, they'll buy one dose, and then be frustrated a month later when they're still having the problem. And what happens is, you know, during that month after using it, you know, you'll wipe out all the fleas on the animal, but meanwhile the other ones in the home are springing to life and you're going to see them. So until the environment has pretty much depleted its supply of fleas, you're going to keep seeing them. And that frustrates people because it, to their eyes, it looks like the product isn't working. And this is true of any of them. I mean, there's, you know, Frontline is the one that was mentioned in the question, but there are other preventatives and they all work in very different ways but none of them will just magically make the problem go away instantaneously. It just doesn't work that way.
All right. And again, SevoWeekly.com, you can find a variety of articles from the past, not quite
about a year,
but
doing it, yeah.
that Dr. Mike Feetz has written about various interesting topics. I see the phone line ringing now, 434-979-0919. Call up with your question for Mike. Let me take a moment while Angie processes this call, is that Lazarus is with us,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately for Lazarus, there probably will be questions about his personal health issues. There's no doctor-patient privilege here when talking about a veterinarian and the dog. But today is my friend Sarah Landon's birthday, and Sarah was the person who brought Lazarus and I together. So a special shout-out, happy birthday to my friend Sarah Landon.
And just to address really quickly, there is patient confidentiality with animals.
Well, fortunately, yeah. Lazarus won't process yeah. that. Hang on a second. And let's take our call from Joanna. Hi, Joanna. Here, you want to make a comment?
Let's see. I just have a comment to make for all the pet owners out there and for the doctors specifically out there who keep basically not doing any research online about real alternatives to Frontline, which is a poison, okay? It's a absolute poison for your pets. Over many years, it will give your animals disease, cancer, whatever else. There's all kinds of studies out there. You just have to look them up. The good news is that there's a new, it's nanotechnology, okay? You have to look this up online. Pet Protector. It is a medallion your cat or dog can wear around their neck. It lasts for 2 years, and it absolutely works. I'm using one now. There are 20 million sold around the world, and no returns. So, and I've been using it for 2 months now. My cat, who had a horrible flea infestation herself last year, she almost died, actually, from infectious anemia from fleas. And she's doing great. She has her Pet Protector on, and it works. And the stuff is out there. This thing was invented in Spain. The studies are out there. You can prove that it works. And I just wanted to let all the pet owners out there to go online and look up Pet Protector.
All right, Joanna. Thanks very much. I you know, it's always nice to get, because I've got a question here from another friend who sent something through me about pesticides. So
yeah.
There you go. Thanks,
yeah.
Joanna, for the call.
So to address it really quickly, these things are, they're incredibly safe. And I worry any time we start using words like poison and toxin, and they're scary words, and I don't think they represent the situation as it is. Any medication in the right dose is going to be toxic or poisonous. And we're always, you know, looking at using doses that are appropriate to solve a problem, and no more than that. But if the dose is used for flea and tick preventative, I mean, the products on the market are just unbelievably safe. As far as studies about them causing disease, there just aren't any. And I also worry that you know, the internet in particular has made things very difficult. You know, in some ways it's a great source of information. It's also a very great source of misinformation. And it's very easy to read blogs and small, you know, posts by anyone that wants to say anything, and misconstrue it as research and study. Veterinarians are, and any doctor really, well aware of the research going on any topic. I definitely sympathize with concerns about using products. And I think, you know, people should look at everything with a bit of a skeptical eye and say, do I need this? Why am I using it? But in the end, the information is there. And if I didn't think these things were safe, I wouldn't be recommending them.
Well, Joanna, thank you, because it's an important conversation to have. 434-979-0919. Our conversation today with Dr. Mike Feetz from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital. Call up with your questions about pets, or in this specific case, what's the word they want to use? It's a product meant to help your pets, and Joanna thinks that it maybe falls on the other side of the line. But you are not, you're supposed to put it in a specific place where the pet can't lick it.
Yeah, actually, that has more to do with its efficacy than anything else. If they do ingest it, and I'm speaking very broadly here because there's multiple products, and I don't want to, it's hard to talk about all of them at the same time, but the concerns about ingestion have more to do with if they ingest it, it will no longer be on their skin and it won't work. The concern about them ingesting it isn't that it's going to hurt them.
Yeah. All right. I've got, as we talk about poisons, I guess was the word that Joanna used. There's another question that a Facebook page person sent to me. Let's see. We just moved to the area this summer, purchased a home with the invisible fencing for pets. It has seemed to work fine, but I'm worried because a next-door neighbor uses, all caps, lots of chemicals and pesticides on her yard and landscaping. Is this in any way a concern?
It's in some way a concern. I think, you know, it depends a little bit on what they're using. You know, the sorts of pesticides used for environmental pest control are very, sometimes they overlap with the ones used on animals and sometimes they don't. And some really aren't safe for animals. So it depends what kinds they're using. You know, without knowing for sure, I would certainly err on the side of caution. And, you know, if you know your neighbor, you should certainly talk to them and, you know, just try and make sure they're keeping it on their side of the property. You know, some of it can always end up in your yard, I suppose. Yeah, but other than recommending common sense measures to protect your own animals, my bigger concerns with things like invisible fencing, which do work, and a lot of people get a lot of good use out of them, they don't keep things out of your yard. And, you know, pesticides are you know, the example we're using here, but I do see animals with invisible fencing come in because they're, you know, injured by other dogs that pass through the yard. It doesn't protect from things like, you know, if a child wanders into your yard and gets bit, you know, there's legal ramifications to things like that. So I think invisible fencing has its purpose, but it's not, it has its limitations as well.
All right, 11:14 with our guest today, Dr. Mike Feetz from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in the Charlottesville area. Also a regular contributor to the Seaville Weekly with articles about pets. Call us up, 434-979-0919.
And support for WNRN Today coming from T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
Support for WNRN comes from Commonwealth Restaurant and Sky Bar, 422 East Main Street on Charlottesville's downtown mall. Serving dinner and drinks in the bar or at the Sky Bar overlooking the mall. Commonwealth is available for private parties and serves brunch on Sundays. For more information, it's commonwealthskybar.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for tuning in. Our guest today, Dr. Mike Feetz, taking your questions or comments about pets, giving out answers, regular conversations. Take advantage. 434-979-0919. We take a minute and remind folks that Angie's going off to college, so we're looking for a second producer for the show. If you have interest in the program or know someone who does, available about two Sundays a month and have a basic ability with computers, we can teach you the rest. You can email me at rmoore@wnrn.org or just stop by the station. Ask about being a volunteer. All right, Mike, the question that I just provided was a little bit related to plants, the neighbor using potential toxics on the plants. But there's natural toxics as well. Again, back to one of the articles that you wrote that I found fascinating was you can't just let your pet wander around and assume that playing in the yard or chewing grass is always safe.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of things we keep in the yard can be dangerous to animals. You know, luckily, a lot of them are very dose-dependent. And again, this goes back to the entire idea of poisons and toxins. You know, that word ignores, in a lot of cases, the dose dependency of these things. You know, one of the ones I think I mentioned in the article are tomatoes, which have the potential to be toxic to dogs. But they also have to eat a tremendous amount of it. So it's one of those things, you know, if you just looked up, are tomatoes toxic to dogs? The short answer would be yes, but the longer answer should allay a lot of the concerns you have about tomatoes being toxic to dogs. You know, that said, a lot of these things are, you know, you do want to, if you do know a plant is toxic to a dog, because dogs aren't known for their discretion, so if they do start chowing down on a plant, they might go wild. You know, you still want to exercise caution. I think there's a difference between exercising caution and panicking. And, you know, that's where I think a lot of these concerns need to be steered. You know, it's one thing to be worried about something and another to let it paralyze you and you know, try and have your dog live in a bubble. But yeah.
When you talk about, whatever phrase you used about how many tomatoes your dog would have to eat to be toxic. Are we talking about two or three? Are you talking about the nasty tomatoes that you threw out in the trash and your dog breaks into it and eats 2 or 3 pounds?
No, it depends a lot on... So, you know, the tomatoes that we eat, at the point that they are fully ripened fruit, contain extremely low amounts of the toxins we're talking about. So chances are you don't have enough properly ripened tomatoes in your home to cause toxicity in a typical sized dog. I mean, I would easily suspect most veterinarians go their entire careers without ever once worrying about tomato toxicity. The green parts of the plant, or the fruit before it's ripened, have it in higher concentration, and that's where it could potentially be a concern if a dog really went to town on a plant.
Phone line ringing now. So what we're talking about is if your dog is helping you in the garden by chewing leaves off the plants. You know, regular access to garden care. Here's a question. Don't forget, you can also send me WNRN studio for your instant message. How do you tell... Oh, excuse me. I was about to read that improperly. How do you tell the length to cut your dog's toenails?
It depends how long they are already.
But what's too short?
There is no too short. I think the problem is that, I mean, there's a natural limit to how short they can possibly get. But the issue is that at the moment you're cutting them, that you not cut so far back that you injure the quick of the nail. There are blood vessels and nerves inside the nail, and you really don't want to be hitting those. If you trim them more often, that quick will gradually recede and let you trim them back further and further. It's really easy to visualize in dogs with white nails because you can actually see the red quick in there and avoid it. But in dogs with black nails, it can become difficult. And unfortunately, a lot of pet owners will respond to that difficulty by just not doing it, which allows the nails to get longer and longer. Yeah, the nails get longer and longer, and then it's harder and harder to trim them back when they reach that length.
That's me. All right, we got a call.
You're not alone.
Hey, Teresa, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
We're well. Question for Mike.
Yes, I'm bringing home a new puppy today, nine weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
He has had his first round of shots.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if it's safe for us to take him out walking, socializing, or do we need to wait until he's had his second round of shots?
I think as long as you're judicious about where you go and who you're socializing with, it's okay. This is a common concern with new puppies, and it's certainly true that until their series is complete, we worry that their immunity is still pretty imperfect. At the same time, that's an age at which puppies really do need to be socializing, both with people and animals. I mean, it's just part of their normal development. And I worry about, you know, puppies being kept behind this protective shield until they reach that age because they're being denied the chance to socialize properly. What I typically advise is, you know, if you have friends and family with dogs that you know are well taken care of, you know, those aren't dogs that your puppy is going to catch anything from. Or if they do, it's going to be minor things. You know, they'll catch the sniffles, but they're not going to get something like parvovirus or distemper from, you know, the dog of, you know, the properly cared for dog of someone that you know well. Likewise, in a town like this that's pretty animal happy, you know, even places like downtown, you know, pedestrian areas, they're pretty clean and pretty safe. I think as long as you keep your wits about you and avoid anything that just seems sketchy, you'll probably be fine.
All right.
Okay,
thanks,
Brian,
Teresa.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Phone lines open again, 434-979-0919. Dr. Mike Feetz from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in Charlottesville. Answering your questions, talking about some of the articles, columns that he's written for Seaville Weekly here in Charlottesville. Dr. Feetz, that reminded me of a question I had about that popped up about the dangerous mm-hmm. plants, potentially.
Yeah.
I don't want to scare people into that either. But can dogs pass along poison ivy or poison oak?
Yeah, in small amount. If someone is really sensitive to poison ivy, this can be an issue. You know, the oil in those plants that causes the reaction, dogs to some extent are shielded from it by their fur, but if the oil gets on their fur in large amount, then potentially they can transfer it. It's not something that I think happens tremendously frequently, and I think the dog would really have to just about roll in it, I think, to have enough on them to create major problems, but dogs do that, so it's possible. You know, if a dog just brushes past some poison ivy, the only risk is the small amount of oil they've managed to pick up on their fur.
All right.
Yeah.
Call up with your questions for Dr. Feetz, 434-979-0919. Thanks to Teresa and Joanna for getting us started with that. One of my favorite columns that you wrote was about naming the pets.
Uh-huh.
Talk about that a little bit.
You know, I think it's one of the fun parts at the beginning of getting a dog or cat, I think, is finding a name that you like and says something about you and says something about the dog and or cat. Yeah, I just think I really enjoy seeing the names people come up with at work, and it's some of them are very, very creative and interesting, and it's just fun to pick their brains and see how they came up with it.
Tell us about the one that caused you to write the column. Or the other one, you mentioned
I'm sorry?
Your dog's name.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned your dog. But there was
yeah.
another dog that you mentioned in that column.
I'm not sure I recall.
Batman?
Oh, Batman. Yeah, Batman was a cute little thing. He was a little hound dog, and there wasn't anything athletic about him. He was this roly-poly little thing, and you know, Batman was just such an ironic name for him, and when I turned to the owner and asked where the name came from, she kind of gestured over to her five-year-old sitting in the corner, and I guess he looked at the dog and said, "This is my dog, Batman."
Mm-hmm. I love that. All right, so here's another question that we've gotten today. Again, WNRN Studio for your instant message, 434-979-0919 for your call to Dr. Mike Feetz, Georgetown Veterinary Hospital, with his degree from Cornell University. Here's a question that I got about cats,
mm-hmm.
about a cat. This couple has a 7-year-old male neutered tabby, has stopped using the litter box the last 3 days. The box is generally emptied daily, but has been completely washed and filled with fresh litter. The same brand as always. They have an appointment with the vet on Monday, but are interested in your thoughts.
So, and there's a little bit of information I'm missing here. I assume when they say not using the box that he's urinating or defecating elsewhere.
Yes, that's my understanding.
Yeah, if it's, you know, the urine side of it frequently turns out to be something like a urinary tract infection or bladder stones, all of which are diagnosable and treatable fairly easily. When it's both, then I start to become more concerned about a behavioral problem. But even behavioral problems can frequently have an underlying medical reason. So, you know, while there's no physiologic reason that a urinary tract infection would cause a cat to defecate in the wrong place, sometimes the stress associated with a urinary tract infection could result in them doing that. So a lot of times it's just a broad check for any sources of stress or unhappiness, and if they're medical, then addressing those will commonly fix the problem. There's other reasons for litter box aversion, though. If a cat ever is frightened for any reason in a litter box, let's say a litter box is near the clothes dryer or something like that, and they were in there one day and the buzzer went off and startled them, some of them just won't go back. And it can take a while to retrain them and coax them to go back in. But if it turns out to not be a medical problem, you might be looking at experimenting with different types of boxes, different types of litter. But it's a pretty broad field of possibilities, honestly.
And I don't know if they're listening. The reason they sent me the question to ask was because I think they were going to listen to the podcast afterwards. But so you brought that up at the end, that maybe you do need to change the litter, even though it's a brand that's been used for quite some time.
Yeah, you know, cats are odd animals, and they can develop aversions to things. You know, knowing why they've done it can be impossible to figure out, but sometimes they just decide they don't like the feel of it anymore. They want something different. So sometimes experimenting with different textures and different types of litter.
Don't like the feel of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got to stand in it.
Non-cat owner, explain that a little bit to me.
Cats are very weird, and they, you know, they can just decide they don't like the feel of something between their toes, and that's it. They're not going to do it anymore. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it better than that. I can't get in their head.
How do you, if you move to a new place? That was one of the questions earlier. Was the people who had just moved and to the neighbor with a pesticide?
Yeah.
If you're moving to a new place, how do you get your cat to use the litter box in a new place?
It's honestly usually very easy. I think one of the frustrations people have with cats and litter training is actually the fact that most cats don't require litter training. In general, if you get a cat and put it in a home with a litter box, they just know to use the litter box. And, you know, it's not like dogs where you're spending, you know, months on crate training and getting them used to going in the right spot. And unfortunately, because it's so easy in almost every case, the situations where it's not easy are very frustrating. When the answer is basically your cat is not acting like a normal cat, that can be really tough. And, you know, there is no crate training for cats. It just doesn't work that way with cats. So what you're stuck doing is trying to make the box as alluring as possible. And otherwise, you know, it depends otherwise on the details of the situation. You know, if you've got a cat that is not going in the box, but they are reliably going in a specific location, sometimes you can start by putting a box in that location and they'll use it instead. So, you know, a lot of it is just working with the cat and trying to figure out why they're doing these things. And I think I told you in the past, I think we were talking about my cat, on one of my other visits to the show, and she had an awful issue where she kept peeing on my bed. And, you know, she did use her litter box, but she also, for whatever reason, decided that my bed was an appropriate target for urinating. And, you know, you can be beside yourself for a while with these situations, trying to figure out what to do. And I tried all sorts of things. I tried feeding her on the bed, seeing if that would, you know, change her perception of what the bed is. And in the end, I just had to train her not to go on the bed. To physically, you know, be on the bed at all. I had to train her to just not jump up there anymore. And
can you tell me that with like aluminum foil or something?
What I ended up doing, I mean, it makes me feel ridiculous every time I tell this story, but I bought rolls of masking tape and just stretched it out over the bed in this big sticky side up web. And for 2 weeks I slept under this ridiculous queen size masking tape blanket, and every time she tried jumping on the bed, she'd stick to it and get upset and jump off again. And that was about 5 years ago, and now she knows not to go on the bed. So sometimes it's a matter of, you know, isolating what your cat is gravitating towards and preventing them from getting to it. You know, another common one is laundry, and then the solution is keep the laundry off the floor.
All right, let's. Yeah. That is a rather ridiculous, funny and necessary story.
Yeah.
A call from Renee. Hey, Renee.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. You got a question for Dr. Feetz?
I sure do. I have several dogs that I have gotten out of kill shelters, mm-hmm. and one of the little dogs, she's a little chihuahua, she constantly licks the carpets.
Yeah.
And my pillowcase and the bed and me, everything. She just licks, and I have to tell her, you know, to stop licking, and she'll look at me and she'll stop for a minute, but then she goes back to licking.
Has she always done this, or is this new?
No, when I first got her, she actually was quite a mess. She was a puppy mill mm-hmm. breeder dog, and when she couldn't produce anymore, she was dumped at a kill shelter.
Right.
And I took her and her brother, and they had never been around people. They had never eaten out of a bowl. Mm-hmm. The food was always just thrown on a cement floor for them. So it's taken a couple years to socialize them.
Sure.
And she probably just started doing this about a year ago. I've had her for about 2.5 years.
It's interesting that it's a change. And, you know, sometimes you can just write things up to behavioral quirk. But seeing as she didn't always do it and then started at some point, you know, it does make you wonder if there's any kind of underlying reason for it. There's no single condition that immediately lights up in my head when I hear someone describe this, but the, you know, the common things, especially given her breed, it could be related to some kind of dental discomfort, and chihuahuas have awful teeth in general. So, you know, it may be a dental thing. I've seen dogs, you know, this one's tough because we can't ask them, but I've seen dogs where constant licking is at least initially thought to be associated maybe with some kind of reflux issue, and they're trying to swallow. And, you know, in those ones, I've experimented with things like antacids to very mixed result. And then otherwise, in a lot of these cases, it does turn out to be just a neurotic habit.
And that's kind of what I'm coming to think.
Yeah. And it may well be. And if it is, if it is, it's tough to say what to do. I mean, it goes in the same box with any other neurotic behavior that dogs have, or anxieties, things like that. You know, the recommendations are mostly just behavioral unless you're at your wit's end. You know, trying to keep them tired so they're less stressed, trying to occupy them with other things and distract them. I don't know that it's something of the severity where I would consider any kind of medical management unless there was some other underlying condition. But it's a pretty wide field of possibilities, which makes those cases even more frustrating.
Yeah.
All right, Renee, thanks for the call.
Just let her keep licking and, you know, I try to give her a toy or a bone to take her mind off of it.
Which I think is the right thing to do, you know, just distracting her and giving her alternatives.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. I'm glad she got a good home.
All right, phone lines open again. Thanks, Renee, for that call. 434-979-0919, Dr. Mike Feetz from Charlottesville's Georgetown Veterinary Hospital. Call up with your question. You know, you mentioned dogs of Renee's type having mm-hmm. horrible teeth.
Yeah.
Well, there's a hound in the room here that has horrible teeth, and it seems like every year since he and I've been together mm-hmm. and we go to Georgetown for some dental work, that he always loses a couple more teeth.
Yeah.
And the reminder is, well, you know, by the time I got him, he already had horrible teeth.
Yep.
But I'm not helping things because, you know, he needs to have his teeth brushed at least occasionally.
Yeah.
But he dislikes that so much. How do you... You know, what are there any tricks into helping your dog accept a little dental care?
Yeah, I mean, there's tricks. They may not work reliably.
He loves the toothpaste flavor.
Just doesn't like the brushing.
But not the toothbrush.
Yeah, you know, dental care is important in animals. And I think one of the reasons it's been hard for this issue to get traction, I think, because it's really only the last 10, maybe 20 years that veterinarians have been focusing on it. And, you know, until then, teeth really were just ignored. They just rotted out of their heads and probably caused a lot of pain and discomfort in the meantime. You know, brushing is pretty much the gold standard as far as preventing dental disease, but it's imperfect for a lot of reasons. It really needs to be done frequently. Owners mean well, and they'll frequently tell me, they brush his teeth every week or two, and it's a waste of time to do it at that rate. I mean, it's something you really want to do every day or so, and maybe every other day at the minimum, if you want to have an impact. But a lot of animals do resent it. A lot of dogs resent it, and nearly all cats resent it. And that makes it harder to do. No one likes to be the bad guy. The dog runs away as soon as they see the toothbrush. I think, part of it is just finding ways to make it more enjoyable, associating it with other treats, things like that. And I freely confess, I struggle with this with my own dog. Despite giving the recommendation to brush teeth, I can't do it with mine. He struggles so much that it's just, it's a waste of everybody's time. And in those cases, unfortunately, you lose ground preventatively, and you're stuck reacting to the accumulation of disease rather than preventing it, which is not an ideal place to be, but sometimes that's where we end up.
11:36 here on WNRN Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Dr. Mike Feats from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital. We're taking questions, having conversations about pets. Call us up, 434-979-0919. You can be next.
WNRN is supported by Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Sonata Hybrid, 38 miles per gallon highway, and breakthrough lithium polymer technology. Also the 38 miles per gallon highway Elantra. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
WNRN is supported by Ragged Mountain Running Shop, number 3 Elliewood Avenue on the UVA corner. Ragged Mountain specializes in hard-to-fit feet, injury resolution, and training advice, and features nearly a dozen brands of running shoes. Charlottesville's community running headquarters since 1982, the Ragged Mountain Running Shop.
Hi, I'm Lou Morrison from Stanton's Jazz in the Park Concert Series, presenting the 26th season of Jazz in the Park. This free summer concert series happens every Thursday night at 8 p.m. at the Gypsy Hill Park Bandstand. This week, we invite you to enjoy Le Hot Club playing authentic gypsy jazz. This show will happen rain or shine. Bring a lawn chair or blanket, and concessions will be available. For more info, call Lou or Lisa Morrison, 540-337-6944. I'm Lou Morrison, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks again for being with us today here on the Wake-Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Joining me today, Dr. Mike Feats from Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in Charlottesville. Let me take a moment and remind you, there is no show currently scheduled for next week. Looking for a topic and some guests. So if you have a suggested topic to discuss or an organization that you believe deserves focus, let me know. I'm always open to that. And let's see, we got a call from David. Hey, David.
Hello.
Your question for Dr. Feats.
Well, you touched on earlier poison ivy, poison oak.
Uh-huh.
I'm not so concerned about my cat giving it to me, but I actually got some a little while ago, and uh-huh. Before I knew it, I had scratched myself, and I think I may have, scratching her on the head, I may have given it to her.
You could, I mean.
I feel terrible. But there was just a little bit of scabbing and stuff up around behind her ears. I don't know if it was her scratching at a flea or if I had actually given her poison ivy.
It's tough
poison
to know.
And should I do something about that?
So my suspicion is it's not the poison ivy. Especially once you've bathed or anything, I mean, once the oil's not really on you anymore, it's just hard to imagine that you had enough, on your hands to bother her. More likely, if you're seeing little scabs around the ears, veterinarians will refer to that pattern of scabs around the ears, especially as it gets worse and worse, as miliary dermatitis, which is kind of a fancy way of saying the cat has an itchy head. And it's usually allergy related. To what is hard to say. Fleas are on the list, certainly. Any other number of environmental allergens, things like that, can do it as well. In minor cases, we often just kind of let it ride as long as the cat isn't extremely uncomfortable. If it does start getting really uncomfortable, then I'd have her checked out. We usually manage it pretty conservatively with just anti-itch medication, honestly. But as long as it doesn't seem to be spreading out of control and she doesn't seem to be terribly uncomfortable, I would probably just keep my eye on it for the time being. The other thing to look for is just check in her ears. If she's got anything like ear mites and that's causing her to scratch at her ears, then she could be giving herself scabs behind the ears.
All right.
Yeah.
Actually, now that you said ear mites,
uh-huh.
I have been told that olive oil can be used to treat ear mites.
Olive
oil will suffocate them. Is this real?
It will suffocate them. It's not a very efficient way of getting rid of them, and I worry about introducing more trouble than you're getting rid of. Usually, you're better off managing it medically. You'll get rid of them faster, and I think you're less likely to introduce infection into the ear by pouring things like olive oil in there. It will suffocate them, though. I tend to find, though, when I've seen owners attempt to use treatments like that for it, I frequently find it keeps coming back, just because it doesn't suffocate all of them. It diminishes the problem, but it always leaves a few mites unchecked, and then it just keeps coming back.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have one comment,
sure.
If you don't mind.
Yeah.
You were talking about naming a cat.
Uh-huh.
I had a cat had a all-white face and a little black mustache over his right in front of his nose.
Uh-huh.
And I called him Groucho. just before I moved away, I found out that the little old lady next door, based on his mustache and the impact he had on local fauna, called him Hitler.
Aw, I think Groucho's the better choice.
Yes. Definitely.
So then, name has to fit the cat.
Agreed.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
All right, phone lines open. Yeah, a Groucho, much better name. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Questions or comments about your pets with our guest today, Dr. Mike Feetz. Dr. Feetz, the part of that came up, I want to talk about senior dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when Dave was talking, I saw that Lazarus got up and came over to you for a little scratching, a little love. We often talk about during the summertime, don't leave your dog in the car. Actually, one of your articles that you wrote about overheating also said, hey, this isn't just the summer problem. This can happen
it's
winter.
Not. Yeah, I see it in the winter, yeah.
But for senior dogs, is there a body temperature issue? I would hope that all of our listeners on this topic today are aware that you can't leave your dog in the car as in the summer because there's, it gets too hot. I think the word that I read was like a greenhouse.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly a greenhouse. The light enters and then it doesn't escape again and it heats up very quickly.
Hang on, Melissa. So, but is there an issue regarding, I have visions of my grandmother with her. It's a July day,
uh-huh.
And she's talking about that the air conditioner is set too
sure.
low, and everyone else is like, good grief, you're talking about it set on 74 because you were saying you're too cold.
Yep.
Do senior dogs have similar problems with body temperature control?
They can. As they get older, they tend to be more sedentary, they exercise less, and that will frequently come with varying amounts of muscle atrophy and just overall loss of body mass. And they can. I don't think there's any special precaution you need to take unless you see evidence of it happening. So, if you notice your dog tends to, lay on the carpet and shiver or seem cold, then I would provide some way of keeping him warm. But other than that, yeah, I would just observe them. But it's certainly reasonable to think that they would have trouble with that kind of thing.
Yeah, because, I bring that up. Lazarus in the summer, wants to lay on the bed with the fan blowing
yep.
over him.
Yep.
But in the winter, he's on the bed, and I feel like I have to go, roll half mm-hmm. of the blanket over him to prevent any shivering, which
sure.
he will sometimes have.
Yep, and that makes sense.
All mm-hmm. right. Call from Melissa. Hey, Melissa.
Hi.
Question for Dr. Feetz.
Yes. I have a poodle with Lyme disease. He was diagnosed on the 11th.
Uh-huh.
he started his antibiotics on the 12th.
Uh-huh.
And I'm noticing that his balance is off. He seems kind of stiff when he's jumping down. He's not doing it very fluidly. He threw up on Friday, and he has not eaten since.
So a couple things. So was he diagnosed just on routine screening, or was he acting sick when you found out?
It was a routine screen.
Routine screen. It would be odd for symptoms to happen to show up after he started the antibiotic.
So I'm
concerned about your description of dizziness and stiffness, and I worry that it's more likely to be something completely else. The vomiting makes sense, just because doxycycline is the antibiotic used to treat Lyme disease, and it does frequently come with a pretty good amount of stomach upset. You know, it's possible if his stomach is that upset and he's gone off food that it's weakening him, and that's what's showing is this kind of apparent balance loss. But anytime anyone describes to me balance loss or stiffness, I think it's worth getting him checked out. It's very hard for me to ascribe that to Lyme's disease while it's being treated.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that is true of Lyme's disease is that if a dog is symptomatic, if they are, the usual symptom with Lyme's disease in dogs is an infectious arthritis. So they do get very stiff and painful. But typically, starting the antibiotic will resolve those symptoms usually within the day. I mean, it's a miraculous recovery when you treat it. So to see him demonstrating symptoms while on it just doesn't sound likely. And it makes me wonder about something else going on here.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Melissa, best of luck with that.
Thanks.
Again, phone lines are open, 434-979-0919. This is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, talking with Dr. Mike Feats at Georgetown Veterinary Hospital. And, you know, I proclaim no knowledge of veterinary skills other than what I've learned from being a dog caretaker with mm-hmm. Lazarus, because that's what I feel like. I'm not an owner. I am the caretaker of this dog. But a sure sign that there's a problem is when Lazarus doesn't eat.
Sure. It's true of a lot of dogs, yeah.
And, you know, and that's something we had a major issue back in March mm-hmm. of 2012, because while he was, you know, he got sick and then he was okay, seemingly. But when the dog who goes outside to take care of morning business and then stands at the door, sort of like hopping back and forth, waiting for me to open the door so he can run to his bowl,
mm-hmm.
doesn't eat, there's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those are worrisome, just because it's any time a dog that loves food isn't eating, I mean, something's wrong, and it may range anywhere from minor to serious. But it's such a non-specific symptom that you know, you're stuck with this very wide field of possibilities unless other symptoms are guiding you towards an answer.
Here's a question we have for Dr. Feats. Family taking our first ever vacation with a pet, rescued 4-year-old terrier mix. Other than overheating concerns, do you have suggestions on how to make it smooth for all of us?
Yeah, and it depends on, you know, the type of trip, how often the animal's going to be left alone. You know, changing their environment like that, animals are very routine-based, and anytime you break that routine, it can be difficult for them, especially if they don't have you to look to. And you know, you'll see that if you take your animal to a pet friendly hotel, for instance, you know, most of them will probably do fine. But as the owner of a dog with separation anxiety, for instance, you know, I can vouch that my dog would not be fine under that circumstance, and I would come back and find my hotel room destroyed. I think, you know, bringing comforts of home and bringing things that, you know, let them know everything is okay, and then trying as much as you can to spend time with them on that vacation. You know, if this is a beach vacation or something, that might be very easy, because the dog might just be running around with you, you know, while, you know, enjoying vacation just as much as you are. But I think that's the big thing, is just bringing some comforts of home so that they don't feel completely out of sorts.
All right. Thanks for the question. 11:49 here on the Wake Up Call. About 10 minutes left for you to call up with your question for Dr. Feats. 434-979-0919.
Support today for WNRN comes from the Jefferson Theater, presenting Dan Deacon Ensemble with Gull and New Depth, Thursday, July 25th. Dan Deacon's jubilant electronic music show returns to Charlottesville. Tickets for the July 25th show are at jeffersontheater.com. Dan Deacon Ensemble, Thursday at the Jefferson Theater.
You can support independent music radio WNRN by donating your car. Get rid of your unwanted vehicle, qualify for a tax deduction, and support the programming you rely on. You can find out more by donating your car, motorcycle, boat, or RV at WNRN.org/donate-your-car.
Again, this is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Let me remind folks to check out the WNRN studio sessions on our YouTube channel. Groups like Alabama Shakes, Barnaby Bright, Robert Cray, and Wild Feathers are just a sample of the intimate studio sessions that you can watch. Go to WNRN.org to see Independent Music Radio's YouTube channel, made possible with support from TuneIn. All right, back with our guest in the studio today, Dr. Mike Feats. Mike, we're sort of tying a couple things together from the last question about the family taking the terrier on their vacation, mm-hmm. And then senior dogs. I recently took Lazarus on the, you know, the large family vacation to the beach in a very dog-friendly place. But this huge house that we stayed in had like 22 steps to get in the main front door.
Right.
Which for a dog who's asked me not to give his age is, it wasn't so bad going up because he seems to have very strong rear legs for jumping onto beds, etc. But going down, he always seems to have more trouble going down steps.
Yeah.
Is that because of his, do you think that's because of his eyesight problems or because his, the front legs are weaker?
I think it's possibly a little bit of both. And I think going downstairs is inherently a more awkward action for dogs. And I think we experience this too. You know, if you're hiking up a hill, you know, it might be strenuous, but it's a more natural movement, I think, than going down. You know, when you go down a steep hill, you kind of move in these short, choppy, awkward steps. So I think going down is more difficult for dogs. You know, I watch my own dog at home and, you know, he's young. He has no vision problems, no orthopedic problems, but, you know, he goes down the steps by just barreling down and letting gravity do its work, which scares me because I'm always afraid he's going to break a leg. Whereas going up is a much more measured, normal movement. So it's probably a combination of things. You know, when you combine the awkwardness of the movement with the fact that maybe his vision isn't so good and, you know, maybe he's got a little bit of orthopedic pain, it makes sense that he'd have trouble with them.
All right, we got a call from Dawn. Hi, Dawn.
Oh, hi. Listen, I have a 3-year-old husky that for the last 2 weeks seems to be always rubbing his butt, like if we're walking, even on concrete, on the rugs in the house, and licking at his rectum area.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could help me on that.
The most common things by far, you know, one is an anal sac problem. There are these little scent glands back there that they can get impacted or even infected. And when that happens, they get uncomfortable back there, and that's him trying to relieve the discomfort. That's an easy thing to just swing him by your vet, and they can express them and get it back to normal. The other, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I want to thank you.
Part two, Mike.
Yeah. Well, so the other possibilities. Sometimes it's seasonal allergy. When I see that in conjunction with dogs that are licking a lot at their feet, that sort of thing, sometimes it's just they're itchy. And then in very uncommon circumstances, sometimes we'll see it associated with parasites as well. So it may be worth having a stool sample checked.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Dawn. Thank you. Again, the stool sample check. Follow your dog out with a plastic spoon and a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, take care of things. I love carrying that into Georgetown Veterinary.
And we love receiving it.
Yeah. 434-979-0919, 1154 on the wake-up call. Just a little bit of time left with our guest today, Dr. Mike Feats, Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in the Charlottesville area. Again, 434-979-0919. Mike, here's a question that I walked in with from a friend. Two times this year, I've come home from work and found where my dog, a female gold lab, age 12, has peed on her bed. Of course, she's sleeping in another spot when I get home, so I'm thinking this is just old age. What do you think?
There's a good chance if you're only finding these pools in the bed, and especially with an older female, there's a pretty good chance it's urinary incontinence, which is age-related, but it's also very, in most cases, easily managed medically. My usual recommendation when I hear this particular description is usually to check a urinalysis, make sure it's not something like a urinary tract infection, that sort of thing. If the urine's clean, then we'll often start them on a trial of medication for incontinence, and in nearly every case it clears up very quickly. And it's worth doing, you know, to some extent incontinence is a nuisance sort of disease. It's not dangerous, but as that happens more often, the constant exposure to urine back there can predispose them to localized infections and irritation. So it's worth controlling.
You can't just put cranberry juice in the bowl and make it go away?
not for incontinence, but that won't do much for infections either, right. Honestly.
Got a call from Jason. Hey, Jason.
Yes, sir. I had a behavioral question for you, sure. If you can answer it.
Uh-huh.
I have a Jack Russell Beagle mix. Jacoby.
Uh-huh.
and whenever I go to bed, you know, he's fine. But if I get up in the middle of the night and try to get back into the bed, he starts growling at me, showing his teeth.
Yeah.
Never bites at me, but...
That's a bad thing.
Every night.
Yeah, that's a dominance issue. And I it's hard for me to make any recommendation other than not letting him sleep in the bed. You know, if he ever misinterprets your movement or anything at night, you know, you can get pretty badly bit under those circumstances. But with dogs like that, typically you really need to buckle down and, eliminate a lot of, other dominance related concerns. You know, they really shouldn't be on furniture at all. They should kind of understand that their position is on the floor. I do see a lot of owners get bit under circumstances like these, and a lot of dogs, it gets worse as they get older. When you start to factor in things like orthopedic pain and arthritis, as they're aging, they become more reactive, more likely to bite. This is a situation where eliminating the possibility is probably the safest bet.
Well, I appreciate your answer.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right.
Thanks
for the call. All right. We got time for if somebody wants to call in here at the end of the show, we can take one more call. 434-979-0919. Our guest today, Dr. Mike Feetz. He's a veterinarian at the Georgetown Veterinary Hospital here in the Charlottesville, Virginia, as well as a regular contributor to one of our local weeklies, the Seaville Weekly. I see Angie's taking the phone right now. Real quick, I want to give a shout out to a couple different places. One being Lazarus's original home. People always think about the Albemarle SPCA, people in our area. The Nelson County Almost Home Pet Adoption Center. If you live on the south side of town, south part of the county, please don't forget that you can go there as well to check out some great dogs. Lazarus, obviously the love of my life, pet wise. And in terms of lost pets and doing some work, there's a lost pet site, Virginia Cat Search, on Facebook page. People can go in and check that out. I found that to be heartbreaking, but very helpful to those who have lost their cats, no doubt. Cindy for Dr. Feetz. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. Quick question for Dr. Feetz.
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old terrier mutt, and she seems like she won't eat unless we're there with her. Unless there's another dog around, in that case, she'll scarf it down in like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
She'll sit there all day if we leave her home alone until we're there with her.
Yeah.
Like a normal thing.
Yeah, a lot of dogs are like this. Mine has a bit of this as well. There's mornings where he will just walk away from his food entirely unless I sit there with him while he eats it, which is, it's charming, but it's also annoying. And, you know, most dogs will not, even if that's their inclination, will not put them in a situation where they're, you know, going to starve themselves or anything like that. I mean, most of them, when it comes down to it, will eat. So long as she's not losing weight and everything else, I would regard it just as a behavioral quirk. And it does make sense that she's more inclined to eat when there's other dogs around. They become a little bit more protective of their food, and they'll try and eat it before anyone else does. But so long as her weight is good, I think that's okay.
Okay, it is pretty low, but I think it's just because she's super active, hyper.
Right.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Mike, thanks again so much for coming in today.
Anytime. It's always fun.
I love giving people a chance to call in with questions, and certainly Lazarus loves having you here. Mike Feetz and Lee Channing, Lazarus's favorite guests here on the Wake Up Call. All right. Thanks so much. Les Temps-Perdue up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.